All right, guys, welcome to the show. This is Devil Gets Red-Pilled, episode 187, I think. It is, let's see, what's the date today? It is April 13th,
13.
4 p.m. West Coast time.
And I believe it's 188.
It's 188.
I believe so.
Well, the one we did Saturday was a Patreon episode, but
Okay, so we don't count that in the.
no, those don't count.
Okay.
Those are only for the elites.
I stand corrected.
Soros's, the Pelosi's, the Sanders, the Rothschilds, the reptilians. Speaking of our Patreon donors, we have a new one this week. So thank you to our new donor, Stephanie. You
Thank you.
joined just in time for me to announce that there will not be a Patreon episode this weekend. I am taking it off. I am very, very busy.
You are.
I'm getting baptized on Saturday. Staying up all night, coming home in the morning, and then going back to church in the afternoon for the big feast of that all the people that don't stay up all night go to as well. So,
Now, are you staying up all night for your Easter or for the baptism? For the Easter?
yeah. Baptism's like 11 to 3. Then we go. I'm gonna go to my friend Ryan's house afterwards, so I don't have to drive all the way back, crash it in his spare bedroom. And then we're all gonna get up and go back. And yeah, stay till like 4 in the morning. So big party.
Nice.
I got an email yesterday, like with all the ground rules, and it says that it's like the church's policy on drunkenness and like how you're supposed to not allow your fellow church parishioners to be drunk at church. So I think people party pretty hard, bring out the vodka and stuff like that. I won't be in.
My kind of party.
Yeah, so it's the end of the fast.
Right.
So starting I'm today's my
Whew.
day of eating before I get baptized. So I'm not gonna eat tomorrow and not gonna eat the first part of the day until like 3 o'clock on Saturday. So water and coffee tomorrow and Saturday until I can eat. So it's gonna be rough.
Just water and coffee.
Yeah.
That no protein or anything.
Nothing.
That's going to be rough.
Yeah, it's gonna be hard. And I go to town tomorrow, go to a service tomorrow afternoon. So busy weekend. And
Yeah.
but after that, it's gonna be a 50-day celebration until Pentecost, and then a couple other like little fasting days in between there. There we're always fasting. There's always restrictions every once in a while, you know.
What is Pentecost?
Pentecost is, let's see. I'm not exactly quite sure what it's celebrating. Pentecost. Pentecost is a Christian holiday, which it's the 50th day after Easter. It commemorates the descent of the Holy Spirit upon the apostles and other followers of Jesus while they were in Jerusalem celebrating the Feast of Weeks, as described in the Acts of the Apostles. But I think it's when the Spirit of Christ came back, something like that. That's
Okay.
the first time I ever went to church last year, so that'll be a year for me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Time flies.
Yeah. But other than that, just busy on the farm. Got the new puppy on Tuesday. And he's great.
Oh my God, he's so beautiful.
Little bit scared of me, but I'm working on him every day. I'm bringing him around whenever I do chores, and he's in the barn with the two little bottle babies. And yeah, he's doing good. He's eating a ton of food, and he's a good boy, super stoic.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I really can't wait to see him in person and all the other babies.
Yeah, we're taking a lot of pictures. We finally named we named the homestead finally. got into a big fight yesterday. Ended up coming up with Rising Tide Homestead.
That's very nice.
Yeah, it comes from, you know, the rising tide raises all ships, that saying. And we also live, Tide Creek runs through our farm. So,
right. Yes, that's, I think that's a really good name.
Yeah, I like it too. And yeah, so we're going to get like a sign made, some stickers, all sorts of stuff. And yeah, we started. So yeah, look that up, Rising Tide Homestead on Instagram, guys.
And, yes.
We posted, Emily had a separate Instagram for like her chickens and stuff when we still lived in the suburbs. So you can go follow from like a couple of years ago from us getting like our first chickens at our old house all the way up to what we're doing now. We just renamed the account. So I'm going to start posting videos and all sorts of stuff on there.
Very nice.
Yeah, I'm going to start getting ready to plant a garden. It's kind of nice. Those pigs tore up a big piece of grass, but I think that's where I'm going to put my garden. And I said it on the Patreon last week. I'm going to plant in straw bales. I'm really excited about it. I'm going to do some raised and some straw bales. Unfortunately, we can't plant in the ground because it's so... there's so much water in it here, in standing water. So until we get that drainage situation figured out, either do raised beds or these straw bales seemed like a great idea. Super inexpensive and yeah, looks really, really cool.
I bet it does.
Yeah, it's I think I'm gonna get going on it, and I think I can start planting some of the colder weather stuff now, some of the greens, and as soon as it still gets down in the 30s at night, so it's kind of hard. It's kind of a hard but I want to do a ton of potatoes. I have all these big plastic planter pots. I want to do a bunch of potatoes in there, and so yeah. But
I like Chud's idea of the tires.
Yeah, that's a good idea too. I just don't have a ton of tires laying
around. If you have tires laying around, then it's perfect.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm excited to do that. But that's about all that's going on here. Just waiting. It's super rainy. It's like the weather here is, it just can't make up its mind. It'll like be pouring rain as hard as you've ever seen, and it'll be sunny for 15 minutes and it'll hail. It snowed on Tuesday, and just schizophrenic this time of year, but hopefully we'll be coming out of it soon. I'm getting baptized in the pond. There's a third of an acre pond at our church that's spring water, so it's super cold.
Oh boy,
it'll be like 54 degrees and raining on Saturday. So
oh no.
I gotta go in there.
Then there's some place that you can dry off and put your clothes back on and try to warm up a little bit.
Yeah. My godparents bring me towels and blankets and stuff and change.
Nice.
Put on a baptismal robe. They bought me one of those too. So
how nice.
Yeah. Yeah, they're really great.
Is it okay to be filmed? Do they allow filming of?
Yeah, I think some people film it. It kind of bothers me. Like sometimes when there's like babies getting baptized in there, people are like walking around with like a iPad filming it. I'm not really a big fan of that.
Okay.
I'm not going to film mine. I'm sure you could find some footage online of people getting baptized at my church, but yeah.
Well,
it's kind of like
you. It's you I want to see.
Filming at a concert, you know. I wouldn't want to film at a concert. But if you look at a concert now, all it is people watching.
That's so true. Nobody, I mean, you see it on your little screen. You don't see it.
Yeah.
Just look up. There it is, live.
Yeah, put it in your brain and have that memory for the rest of your life. Like, like how people used to do, like how people could talk about how when they saw The Who in 1977, and you know, it's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be you know.
I spoke, speaking of the Who, to my friend who I mentioned had gone to Woodstock.
Right.
He says they were there. He says he saw them.
Okay.
So.
And that's the big contention, is that they weren't there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so we'll have to.
Have you seen other, because you've been doing a lot of research, have you seen other people online making that speculation?
No, but I haven't been specifically looking for that. So yeah. I will. I will. Yeah. But
yeah, I don't know what to think about it after watching a lot of that footage of the event that we watched, guys. We did another good Woodstock music Patreon last Saturday or Sunday. I thought that was great. I mean, maybe that episode, like the Patreon stuff we're doing, isn't for everybody, but I thought that was super.
Uh-huh. So, yeah. It was super fun for me. Yeah. And I don't even know half those bands. So
yeah, I mean, getting to see that Monsters of Rock in Moscow, that's just so incredible. That's I'm holding to it. That's the greatest rock concert of all time.
Wow.
That would be it's just I watched that footage and it gave me just an emotional experience. More than just shivers. There's like almost tears watching that, you know. So
I get it, because music moves me in that way, although, you know, I'm not a big fan of metal.
Yeah,
is that what you still call it? Is it still called metal?
Yeah, that was heavy metal. I'm not a huge metal fan either. I like a little bit here and there, some more obscure bands, and yeah, I don't, you know, I like Slayer and you know, Metallica is the big one for me, because I'm not like a huge fan anymore. And I think everything post 1991 Black Album was pure garbage. But and a lot of people say that Black Album was pure garbage. I'll dispute that any day with anybody. I think that's a great album. But they were like the first band that I really went super, super deep into. I have an addictive personality. Like the way that I get into stuff is, you know, I got into Metallica big time as a young, you know, I was 12 years old when that album came out, and then I went hard and you know, got into the real early stuff. The real early stuff came out, you know, their first album came out in 83, their first big studio album, when they still weren't famous, but just humble beginnings for that band.
Yeah.
I've been by their house, the house they lived in El Cerrito, you know.
Uh-huh.
Pretty cool. And that, and you know, I lived in Oakland for so long, and they had there was a huge brat thrash metal scene in Oakland and San Francisco. So but yeah, so go and check out the Patreon, guys, after this week, you know, and I'll get an extra episode in there for you guys. So and then I also promised some stuff to the $20 donors that I have not come through on. So we'll figure that out, guys. So sorry if you're waiting on that and you feel betrayed by my word.
No, he will never, trust me, Adam will never betray you.
It remains to be seen. But there was a lot of good stuff in the news this week. To be honest, guys, I'm still out of the news cycle. Kind of feel like taking a step away from the conspiracy world. Like the whole it seemed the whole there's this narrative against Easter got just put out into the ether this year, and I don't know if I noticed it because I'm paying more attention, or if it was extra strong this year, but it just seemed like it got put out there, and all these dummies that can't speak intelligently on it just repeated this narrative of like the Easter being a pagan holiday and the Easter is Ishtar, and it bummed me out. And it's like, it doesn't even take like an understanding of theology or of like secret societies or paganism to prove that it's not right. Because all you have to say is that the Bible wasn't written in English, and Easter was first introduced as a word in the 8th century. Like, that's all you need to know. That destroys the narrative right there. So people were celebrating the resurrection of Jesus in the 2nd century, you know?
And they... Why did they, is there a reason why they chose to name it Easter? Is there,
that's like a translation into from like some Germanic word or something, and then that gets into some sort of Germanic goddess named like Eostre or something like that, but like way further down the road in like 700. So Easter was called Pascha when it started. That's what like we call it. It's the Greek word. And the Bible was written in Greek and Aramaic. So
yeah. Interesting history.
That narrative got put out there, and I just saw so many people like on my Instagram, just people taking like screenshots and not even like editing the screenshot right, so you could still see like the bottom line of someone's Twitter profile, and they're just using that person's post and like reposting it, and they've never looked into it. They're just like, oh, I hate Christianity because the 700 club and I had to go to church with my parents in the 80s and it sucked, you know. I get it. That before I get having a disdain for Christianity, a lot of it deserves it, you know. And but it's just seeing people do that and then making me think like, man, is that how I seem when I'm like talking about stuff that I don't really know a ton about? Because I don't want anything to do with that, or to be like, you know, I don't want to be viewed as that. And even if they were right, like, what's the point? You know, it's just seemed kind of just shitty and mean-spirited. And
yeah, mean-spirited.
But yeah. And it just made me realize it made me feel like for the first time, like, oh, like I always thought like, oh, when it goes bad and like, if the, you know, not the Armageddon, but if like, you know, the zombie apocalypse happens, like people that I thought were my friends, like hate my religious beliefs, like in it, and just seeing this narrative, like put out there, like, oh, I'm not safe when it comes down to it, you know. And I think the government like want, you know, it's just like we saw in Rwanda, they before the genocide, they had these radio programs, and they'd go out, and these people that were government funded would were these DJs, and they'd call, I can't remember if it was the Hutu or the Tutsi, would call the other ones cockroaches, and just little things like that, and it led to you know, a genocide of millions of people. And like right now we're seeing like it is perfectly acceptable to hate Christians on openly in the public, which is Twitter and you know, Instagram and all that stuff. So
I must have a different algorithm. I haven't.
Yeah. But I'm,
I not, mean, you I, know, I get the dogs and the puppies and the,
yeah, that's, and I'm changing. I'm trying to get off of it. I'm unfollowing people and trying to get through it. And, but yeah. So I'm not saying I'm some big victim or anything. I've been, you know, Christian for less than a year. But I'm just saying, when it comes down to it, and the government wants to, like, they can activate people that think that they're not being activated. I think that's what happened. I think that's what that whole campaign was this year. So I think we're all victims of the algorithm and the bubbles and the echo chamber and but all these people that are supposed to be like these open-minded conspiracy people, like
they hate have you started Dr. Mary's Monkeys?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Yeah,
it's really good.
Yeah, I just about finished.
Yeah, I think I've got a couple, maybe an hour left or something like that.
Yeah,
that's really cool. That book is on Trine Day, which is a big publishing company that does like kind of conspiracy minded books. Like they do all Jay Dyer's books, and they're based out of Portland. The guy Chris Milligan, who runs it, his dad was in the CIA. And so he's got like a pretty interesting story. I've tried to get him on a couple times, but I never got from him. But yeah, they've got, you should check them out. It's Trine Day. And but it was cool. That book was free on Audible. I didn't have to use it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, same. Yeah.
Yeah. But so what do you think? The COVID emergency is over.
Wow.
Is that yesterday?
I think it was Tuesday, I think.
Tuesday.
Monday or Tuesday? I don't know. It wasn't in the news.
Yeah, nobody covered it. Do you feel safer?
Oh God, I feel so much safer now that the emergency is over.
Yeah, like why did they choose Tuesday the 11th and not Monday the 10th? What's the difference?
Who knows?
And like if it was an emergency, like why, you know, every press conference we see at the White House, we see Karine Jean-St. Pierre. Why isn't she taking the, I mean, it's an emergency. We're in an emergency.
Yeah, now the emergency is over. I mean, people should know that. They should.
If you got a text from one of your daughters that said, call me right now, it's an emergency. Like, you're on the phone right then, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, but we've been living through an emergency for the past 3 years and a couple months. 15 days. That was a long 15 days, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Lockdown for 15 days. That was, seems like ancient history.
Yeah. The damage is done. There are, we will never, ever recover from this in, if I had children in their lifetimes, it would. We would recover from this. You know, the largest transfer of wealth in the history of the world. The precedent set that this they can do this at any time.
Yep.
I think this was a big experiment on their part. They're like, let's see what we can do. You know.
Let's just see how gullible this public is.
Yeah. I mean, people are dead from things other than COVID. I'd estimate way more because of the lockdowns, how many businesses are lost, how many cities are destroyed. I follow this Instagram page called PDX Real, and they just show like bums, you know, and stuff in Portland. It's pretty devastating, but like pretty much every day they have a post of, they repost like a business that's puts their last Instagram post up, like, we regret after 25 years of service in downtown Portland. We can no longer operate here anymore. Become too dangerous. We can't afford to pay our employees enough to keep them around. We've been paying people hazard pay. We've been sending them to training for, you know, crisis reduction, all this stuff like that. We can't get help from the city or the police, and we can't operate safely here anymore. You know, we've had,
it's so sad.
It's like one, you know, of the, it's like one of those a day.
San Francisco is close on the heels. They closed a Whole Foods because of all the theft. And
the one on Church or the one down south of Market?
I think it's the one south of Market.
Yeah, that's a nice store. I used to go there.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, that one kind of sucked. I would go to the Trader Joe's down there. But yeah.
And, you know, right outside of Salesforce, that's on Rincon Hill, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or Rincon Annex, what's it called? Anyway, that's, you know, there was a stabbing of.
Yeah, the guy who owned. Who,
Cash App. Cash App? Is that Square. What it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah. Yeah, there's some weird stuff around that. A lot. I mean, it could just be a crazy bum. And
no, it was another tech guy.
Another tech guy stabbed him?
Yeah.
They proved that.
Yeah.
Did they catch him?
I believe so.
Because that guy was involved in some crypto stuff. Mm-hmm. So maybe that. Yeah, like No Agenda was saying that maybe it was a hit.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Back to the COVID stuff, like, you know, these cities are ruined because of it. And Oregon, I saw this article from NPR, and they're just so dishonest. Like, Oregon lost 16,000 people last year. And it's like the first time since like 1969 that the state's population hasn't gone up.
Uh-huh.
You know, Or Portland and Oregon was the big place in the 80s whenever where everybody first moved from California. And so there was like this disdain for like Californians in Oregon, like go home, you know. But they lost 16,000 people last year. And the majority of those people are from Multnomah County, which is like this the Portland county.
Yeah.
And it's just like you read the article and NPR says like nothing about like quality of life, safety, or anything. They say like, oh, the cost of housing could be a major factor in this. It's like, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. I browsed through an article last week about the best places to buy a house. And it listed like 30 places. And this was based on you know, the value of your house going up.
Yeah.
There were probably 30 on the list. Half of them were in Texas, if not more.
Yeah. You know,
none in California.
If I lived in Texas, though, that's like not, I mean, if I wanted to like sell my house eventually and move somewhere, maybe I'm not in the mindset of doing that. I want to be where I'm at. And if like I'm living in the state where everyone's coming to,
Yeah.
I don't know if I want that, you know?
Right.
Same with like Tennessee and all that. I don't know. I don't want to live in Nashville, Tennessee. Like I got some cool videos of some people from Tennessee later today that we can watch if you want. But yeah, just all this COVID stuff. I mean, it's irreparable in my opinion. Do you think we can ever recover?
No, I don't. I really don't. I mean, I think, you know, I feel terrible for all these businesses that, you know, had to go under, but I don't think the kids are going to recover.
Yeah.
Just a really tough.
Yeah, I noticed there's families at my church that wore masks up until like a month and a half ago. And they finally thought it was safe enough, even though there was still an emergency, to take off the masks, even though they're taking communion out of a one spoon for the whole church, you know. They believe it's safe, and you know, they believe God will keep them safe for that, but not for the rest of the service, I guess. But they have like a little 5-year-old girl. They have two little girls. One's not wearing a mask, but there's one that's like still wearing it, and that's by choice. No, that's by choice.
She chooses.
Yeah, because the rest of the family isn't.
Wow.
It's really sad to see. And like the majority, like if I go to, nobody wears masks around here. But if I go to, old people do. If I go to Portland, I see families and like the teenage kids, I see wearing masks. But like the parents won't be.
That's so bizarre.
Yeah, there's no like spirit of rebellion left.
Oh, there has to be. That would just be,
there isn't,
the saddest ever.
It's just a homogenized culture of people who think resisting is doing exactly what the mainstream media and academia and Hollywood tells them to do, you know. Do you think that the lockdown set precedent that it could happen again?
Yeah, I do. I do.
Yeah, I think I do too. I think in places like San Francisco and Portland, I think it's like done. You know?
Yeah. I think there are a lot more people today than say a year ago who do not buy it hook, line, and sinker like they did.
Yeah, I think they'd have a lot harder time in outlying areas and stuff. I don't think anybody would do it here. I don't think anybody will do it anywhere rural, but the cities will obviously do it. So, yeah. So, what do you think? There's some people in your life that were pretty scared of the whole deal and continued wearing masks and everything. I don't know, still do. Do you think they feel safer now that the emergency is lifted officially?
I I can't imagine that they do.
Yeah, it's just funny that that's like the word.
Yeah.
We use the word emergency. It's like, okay.
If yeah, that's no.
Like, wolf like that, that word is the same as Nazi now. No meaning left in it, you know?
Yeah, they, I mean, around here, it's like you said, it's only, I think, older people.
Yeah.
And maybe a handful here and there, but yeah.
Yeah,
I remember going to the beach a year ago. I went to the beach today and, you know, there was not a mask to be seen, but a year ago there was.
Yeah. Yeah. It's old people, old boomers, like conservative people, you know, here doing it just because they trust what the news says. And then if you have a tinge of green or blue in your hair and you live, you know, somewhere close to Portland, it's 100%. 100% at the grocery store, Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's is still 50% masks when I go in there in Portland.
You say the people with blue or green hair are masked?
100%.
Blue hair?
They them. Not, they like, them. 100%.
Like young people with blue hair? Is that what you're talking about? Or old ladies with blue
like,
hair?
You know, like every like they them. Every person is 100%.
That's really interesting.
I mean,
I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, it's the end of an era, end of our first 3-year emergency in my lifetime. Hopefully, in another one soon, you know.
Yeah.
Do you have any stories you want to get to, or you said you're a little slow this week?
I am. But I do have a couple of things. I was on, God, the name just flew out of my head. The search engine that you turned me on to.
Threespoke.
Yeah, thank you. And there was a story about Canada's version of the White House.
I don't even know what that is. How big of a loser that is. We don't even they're
well, it doesn't really have a name. They just call it, I don't think they call it anything, but it's a house and it has served as the official residence for over 70 years. And it has been allowed to just fall into shambles. Nobody has lived there since 2015, or that's further ahead. I'll have to look at my
notes. Lived there?
No. Trudeau doesn't live there now. He did as a kid when his father, Pierre Trudeau, was prime minister. But it has gotten into such a state of disrepairs. It's plagued with asbestos, lead, mold, and rodent infestations. The agency that manages the property says there is now this enormous rodent infestation with excrement and carcasses all over the place. And they were recently worried because there was some public garden party on the grounds and a tornado warning, and they were afraid all these people were going to rush into the house to get out of the tornado and, you know, the walls could come down. So the estimated cost to fix it is $26 million. Otherwise, they say a catastrophic collapse of the building could happen due to rusted water pipes, etc. So the house is a 34-room, 12,000-square-foot residence. It's currently described as a national embarrassment. The last renovations were done in 1951 when a guy by the name of Brian Mulroney was prime minister. And he, whenever he had any repair work done, the media would be all over him for, you know, spending money and extravagance. And so,
Sussex Drive.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, is that it? It looked different in the pictures I saw. Oh, that looks like Britain. But so Pierre Trudeau was criticized when he did upgrades to the kitchen and added security. And his political opponents called it a lavish use of public money, although this was paid for by private donors, the kitchen upgrades that he did. But so from that point on, nobody wants to put any money into it because they're afraid they'll get slammed by their opponents. And so there's this guy, J.D.M. Stewart, who wrote a book called Being Prime Minister about Canadians. And he says there is a uniquely Canadian sensibility of kind of being cheap, particularly when it comes to government officials. He says the first prime minister to live at 24 Sussex, who was called Louis Saint Laurent, had to pay $5,000 a month in rent. Or no, that must be a year because it was in the 1950s. It didn't say. But they used to have to pay. The prime ministers had to pay to live there. And they ended that policy in 1971. So now an opinion poll says half the country opposes renovations. And Stewart says that he believes Canada misses out on looking like they have game because of the face they put forward to the outside world. So it was built in 1868 and has sat vacant since 2015. So then I thought, well, interesting. Let's see what our official residence has. The White House, in comparison, is 55,000 square feet, has 132 rooms, 35 bathrooms, 6 levels, 28 fireplaces, 3 elevators. President Washington chose the site with the official city planner back before it was even Washington, D.C. Construction began in 1792, and Washington did oversee construction, but it wasn't finished before he left office. The first president to live there was John Adams in 1800s. It was set on fire by the Brits in 1812, and the same architect who built it was hired to rebuild the stuff damaged in the fire. So Theodore Roosevelt started the first major renovation in 1902, and that's when the West Wing was added. And then 50 years later, Harry Truman began renovations because the White House showed structural weakness, and all the internal walls were removed. Everything but the external walls was dismantled. In those days, well, prior to that, White House servants used to be enslaved people until after the Civil
Yes, that's how
War.
it says. They're called enslaved people, not slaves now.
Enslaved people,
Got it.
and until after the Civil War. And then after that, the wages of all White House employees, as well as the expense of running the house or staging official functions, were all paid for by the president. And then Congress decided to provide pay for all the employees and blah servants in 1909. So up until then, the president paid for it out of his pocket.
So you like hired staff and you didn't like need probably like I'd say 9 out of 10 people that work at the White House don't need to be there probably, but they just tax money.
Renovations, extensive renovations have taken place, as we know. The grounds have also had renovations. Oh, wait, there's something. Where did I put that? Oh, maybe it's coming up in my notes. Theodore Roosevelt started renovations. 50 years later, Harry Truman began renovations because of structural weakness. I just said that. All right, sorry, here it is. renovations have taken place. The grounds have had many, many renovations. A tennis court was put in for Teddy Roosevelt, and it was relocated three times, this tennis court. Obama had removable basketball court lines and baskets added to the tennis courts so he could play basketball. Franklin Roosevelt had an indoor heated swimming pool added.
And so he'd go in there in his wheelchair?
Probably. But this room was later converted to the press room. So there's no more inside swimming pool. Gerald Ford added an outdoor pool, and Eisenhower put in a putting green, and he also installed bowling lanes, which were paid for by his friends from where he was from, Missouri. So Eisenhower didn't have us pay for the bowling lanes, but they were removed in 1955, and Nixon had them reinstalled in 1973. So the White House has been appraised at $400 million, and it's owned by the National Park Service. Presidents are given $100,000 toward redecorating when they enter the White House. Operating expenses are $1.4 billion per year, and this includes staffing, travel, and security, but that's a big old nut, and that is paid by, guess who?
You and me.
You and me.
Well, we don't have jobs, so not us, but...
We pay taxes, though.
Significant others. Donald Trump got there and he said, like, this place is a piece of shit. He just stayed in Florida the whole time. I bet you it is super decrepit and like gross in there. Like, that's what they say about the Playboy Mansion. You ever heard that? Like, it was really like, gross.
Ew.
It's dirty and like falling apart. And, like, yeah.
Who lives there now?
I don't know. That's a whole other, that's a good one to go down to.
Gross. A lot of stories there.
Yeah.
But I thought that was kind of interesting. I hope y'all were too bored.
Have you ever been to the White House?
I have never been. Have you?
Never. No, I've never been to Washington, D.C.
No, nor I.
Yeah. Okay, so remember we covered your buddy Dylan Mulvaney, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Still happening.
Yeah. So Dylan Mulvaney, as we all know, is this stunning, brave, beautiful woman who is an influencer for companies such as Bud Light, Anheuser-Busch, Nike. She's out there dancing in their sports bras, and they provide tons of support for her breasts, and stunning and brave. One of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life. You know, if I wasn't married, you know, I'd give it a shot.
But not.
So the headline for this, is from Zero Hedge. Anheuser-Busch loses $6 billion in 6 days after trans ad campaign that top execs never approved. After reaching a three-year high of $66.73 per share, Bud Light parent company Anheuser-Busch InBev lost more than $6 billion in market cap since announcing its partnership with 26-year-old transgender influencer Dylan Mulvaney on April 2nd, as bar owners and distributors report a sharp decline in Bud Light sales over the past week. The company's market cap fell as low as $125.7 billion, down from $132.8 billion 6 days ago, a drop of more than 5%.
And that top execs didn't know.
Yeah, Bud Light's partnership. Well, that, you remember they told us that, the top execs at Balenciaga didn't know either. Remember that?
You make a good point.
Bud Light's partnership with Mulvaney included custom cans featuring his face and pro-LGBTQ language to commemorate the biological male's Being a woman for over a year, the ad campaign kicked off with naked Mulvaney drinking Bud Light in a bathtub. Go back. We played it. We played that one.
Yeah.
You can see the video of it if you pay $3 a month for the Patreon. While Anheuser-Busch issued a statement in support of Mulvaney, saying it works with hundreds of influencers across her brands as one of many ways to authentically connect with audiences across various demographics, the Daily Wire reports that company executives had no idea about the ad campaign. Quote, no one at the senior level of the company was aware of Bud Light's polarizing partnership with Dylan Mulvaney. Sources close to the situation claim the company is also allegedly pausing its marketing efforts and scrambling to implement a more robust process for evaluating future influencer partnerships. So I wonder how much these influencers get paid and how they get like contracted or allowed to do this, you know?
Yeah, I don't know.
No one at senior, maybe I could become an influencer with our new Instagram page for the farm.
Yeah.
No one at a senior level was aware of this happening, said one source who was granted anonymity to discuss sensitive internal discussions. Some low-level marketing staffer who helps manage the hundreds of influencer engagements must have thought this was no big deal. Obviously it was. So some low-level person lost the company 5% of their net worth.
That's kind of hard to believe that.
Yeah. A second source also claimed that a lower level employee had made the decision to include Mulvaney in the campaign, a move that appears to have cost the company $5 billion in market value. The backlash to the iconic American beer has been so intense that a Budweiser distributor in Missouri canceled an event with the company's famous Clydesdale horses because everything was still sensitive over the matter. Yeah, they're probably going to turn those Clydesdales into glue. And it'll go to the dog food factory, and it'll be all Dylan and some low-level executive's fault. This comes after the company's woke vice president of marketing touted her mandate that made the brand be more inclusive. So they played this on no agenda. This is the company's Alyssa Heinerscheid, Bud Light's VP of marketing, doubles down on an extreme woke strategy to promote the declining American beer brand to young people while smearing her former customers as fratty and out of touch. So let's watch. Oh, come on. If I refresh. Sorry about the delay, guys. Let me see if I can get this to work. That's not what I'm looking for.
Where did she go?
Oh, well. They played it on... Oh, here we go.
There it is.
Well, I'm a businesswoman. Mm-hmm. I had a really clear job to do when I took over Bud Light. And it was, this brand is in decline. It's been in decline for a really long time. And if we...
So they played this on no agenda and they like looked it up and Bud Light's profits and it's not in decline. It's like the biggest brand.
Yeah, it said at the beginning of the article that it was up to its highest.
So she's full of shit. She's lying and she's going to take a bunch of credit for doing stuff that is ruining the brand name.
Do not attract young drinkers to come and drink this brand. There will be no future for Bud Light. So I had this super clear mandate. It's like, mm-hmm. we need to evolve and elevate this incredibly iconic brand. And what I brought to that was a belief in, okay, what does evolve and elevate mean? It means inclusivity. It means shifting the tone. It means having a campaign that's truly
word salad.
Inclusive and feels lighter and brighter and different. And a
word salad.
Appeals to women and to men.
Mm-hmm.
And representation is at sort of the heart of evolution. You've got to see people who reflect you in the work. And we had this hangover. I mean, Bud Light had been kind of a brand of fratty, kind of out of touch humor. And it was really important that we had another approach. So I'm a bit.
I don't know about you. I love Spuds McKenzie, you know. That is great. So, yeah.
Did you see that? I can't remember how he worded it. Don Lemon, your favorite, put out a tweet about how to fix the problem with gun violence, and it was to hire Dylan Mulvaney as NRA spokesperson.
Good one, Don.
Yeah.
Yeah, Don seems kind of like a bitchy gay guy, and we know the a lot of the gays don't really, the older gays don't really get down with the trans dudes. You know what I mean? Older gay guys don't like lesbians. They don't like trans people. You know. So what else we got here? So you can see what we're looking at here. Oh. So let's see, we can do this one. NPR throws giant tantrum, quits Twitter.
Oh.
This is from Zero Hedge also. NPR, National Public Radio, announced on Wednesday that it will stop using Twitter and will no longer post fresh content to its 52 official Twitter feeds. As the first major news organization to qu go quiet on the social media platform, the move comes after Twitter CEO Elon Musk labeled NPR state-affiliated media. We know it is. They take taxpayer money, and and all those COVID bills, those COVID money infusions, they were getting like $25 million at a time.
Well.
And then so they were labeled state-affiliated media and then changed it to government-funded over the weekend after widespread pushback. We are not, quote, we are not putting our journalism on platforms that have demonstrated an interest in undermining our credibility and the public's understanding of our editorial independence, NPR told The Hill. We are turning away from Twitter, but not from our audience and communities. Course, Twitter. Of course, NPR doesn't have the balls to actually nuke their account. Will still allow people to click all their existing content. Instead, they will cease tweets from the various accounts, the primary one of which has over 8 million followers. Last week, Twitter slapped state-affiliated media or similar labels on several outlets, including the BBC. In perhaps their last series of tweets, NPR claims to produce consequential independent journalism every day in service to the public, except when it comes to things like influencing elections by protecting the Biden family from credible reporting on crackhead Hunter's laptop. Well, Zero Hedge has a little bit of a right-wing leaning, I guess.
Got
But
it.
I've got some good little clips of Elon talking to a reporter from the BBC. Would you like to see them?
Sure.
Pretty funny.
He's a weird guy.
Yeah, but he's definitely entertaining to watch, especially when he does stuff like this.
COVID misinformation.
Well, this is some BBC reporter talking to Elon, interviewing Elon Musk. So here we go.
COVID misinformation.
Amazing.
You change the COVID misinformation
Has
rules.
BBC changed its COVID misinformation?
So I guess it does the you anytime you'd put something about like vaccines or COVID on Twitter, there'd be a little label at the bottom that said like COVID facts. So apparently they changed it. I think that's what they're talking about.
The BBC does not set the rules on Twitter, so I'm asking you.
No, I'm talking about the BBC's misinformation about COVID.
I'm literally asking you about you change the labels, the COVID misinformation labels. There used to be a policy, and then disappeared. Why do that?
COVID is no longer an issue. Does the BBC hold itself at all responsible for misinformation regarding masking and side effects of vaccinations and not reporting on that at all? And what about the fact that the BBC was put under pressure by the British government to change its editorial policy? Are you aware of that?
This is this is not an interview about the BBC.
Oh,
so
you thought it wasn't.
I see now why you've done Twitter Spaces. I am not a representative of the BBC's editorial policy. I want to make that clear. Let's talk about something else.
Hoo-hoo.
Well, I've got another good one from the same interview. This guy's a total tool, and all you have to do is ask questions to these people, and they can't. That's why they won't debate or anything. It's because they know their stuff will never pass muster. Like, it doesn't work. This one's a little bit better. This one's 2 minutes and 20 seconds. Come on. Okay, let me see if I can refresh it, make it work.
Content you don't like or hateful? What do you mean to describe a hateful thing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just content that will solicit a reaction, something that may include something that is slightly racist or slightly sexist, those kinds of things.
So you think something is slightly sexist, it should be banned?
Is that
what you're saying?
I'm not saying anything.
Well, I'm just curious. I'm trying to understand what you mean by hateful content. And I'm asking for specific examples. And you just said that if something is slightly sexist, that's hateful content. Does that mean that it should be banned?
Well, you've asked me whether my feed, whether it's got less or more. I'd say it's got slightly more.
That's why I'm asking for examples. Can you name one example?
I honestly don't. You can't name a single example. I'll tell you why, because I don't actually use that for you feed anymore, because I just don't particularly like it.
But you
and
said
actually, a lot of people are quite similar. I only look at my
You said you've seen more hateful content, but you can't name a single example, not even one.
I'm not sure I've used that feed for the last 3 or 4 weeks.
How did you see the hateful content?
Because I've been using Twitter since you've taken it over for the last 6 months.
Okay, so then you must have at some point seen for you hateful content. I'm asking for one example.
Right.
And you can't give a single one.
And I'm saying, I say, sir,
that you don't know what you're talking about.
Really?
Yes, because you can't give me a single example of hateful content, not even one tweet. And yet you claimed that the hateful content was high.
Well,
that's a false.
No, what I claimed.
You just lied.
What I claimed was, there are many organizations that say that that kind of information is on the rise. Now, whether it has on
Give
my feed
one
or
example.
Not, I mean, I, right, and
literally
if you look at something
one.
Like the Strategic Dialogue Institute in the UK, they will say that.
People will say all sorts of nonsense. I'm literally asking for a single example, and you can't name one.
Right, and as I've already said, I don't use that feed. But let's,
well, then how would you know? That
I don't think this is getting anywhere.
You literally said you experienced more hateful content, and then couldn't name a single example.
Right, and as I said,
that's absurd.
I haven't actually looked at that feed.
Then how would you know if it's hateful content?
Because I'm saying that's what I saw a few weeks ago. I can't give you an exact example. Let's move on. We only have a certain amount of time.
Guy likes to say let's move on after he can't. Like, that wasn't particularly brilliant, like, logic or argument or anything from Elon. I was just asking one question,
mm-hmm.
one question to destroy this guy's narrative. You know, these people
pretty effectively too.
They're so used to just not getting that guy's never been asked a question, like a question that he's not supposed to be able to answer in a way that makes him sound intelligent.
Has happened in the past, the person conducting the interview usually is able to turn it around. You know, I'm asking the questions, not you. But was not very effective.
But that guy will go and write for the BBC and say that Twitter's hateful content has risen 83% in the last 3 weeks since I was so offended and had to get off that feed. Like, he just is arguing in circles over and over and over.
Yeah.
Are
you on Twitter?
Yeah. We've got a Twitter page.
Yeah. I've never been on it.
I like Twitter. It's fun. It's, you know, it's just as gross as all the other stuff, but, yeah, it's strange. It's a weird place, and it's fun to go on though. Get a lot of news and stuff up there. That's how I get a lot of guests, is DMing them on Twitter. But yeah, BBC, just another version of NPR, just the British version, you know. But
Yeah.
like their main thing, you know. Like here it's the BBC is like, you know, makes me think of like a guy with a hoarder house and like a corduroy jacket with leather sleeves in Berkeley, you know. Does that make sense? Like
Yeah, NPR, absolutely. Yeah.
I think of my brother-in-law's dad, who's like a Berkeley progressive hippie lawyer, who has like this huge mansion in Berkeley that's like all decrepit and has like pathways of like stacked up books that you have to like walk through in it, you know. Like that's what I think of when I think of NPR. But yeah. Just ask people one question. I remember when Joe Rogan had Bernie Sanders on his show in the summer of 2019, I believe. Maybe, yeah. I think it was before COVID. And like, I was just like, Bernie was like talking about gun control and how it needs to happen and like how we need to take away people's, you know, assault rifles. And Joe Rogan didn't just say, yeah, but how would you do that? Or, yeah, but where would the money come from? Because that's all it takes to like destroy Bernie Sanders is one question. You know, most of these politicians or, you know, reporters, journalists, progressives, one question. Where's the money going to come from? How would you do that? Give me an example. And they can't. And then they say, well, that's a right-wing talking point. You're a Nazi. You're a racist, you know. POC and BIPOC and the trans children, you know, are in a genocide. That's what they'll say. That's how they shut you down. I thought that was a fun watch. You know, people say what you want about Elon. Who know? I'm really confused about what he is, what he's doing, what the goal is. It seems like he's a transhumanist to me, but I enjoy when he does stuff like that. He's brought a lot of attention to a lot of the garbage that's going on, you know. Maybe it's because he promotes his own garbage that's opposite of that and they're in the way, but you know.
I'd read somewhere that he had earned and lost a couple of times huge fortunes before Tesla and before he became a household name, but that he had lost major fortunes and somehow built it all back up again.
Well, I mean, everything he does is government funded. You know, he gets these huge government stipends for Tesla, for SpaceX, for all this stuff. He builds rockets that don't go anywhere. He builds cars that suck and don't go anywhere. Like, and it's all government money, so you know. Did you see the thing about this guy? This guy, I think his name is Justin Pearson.
Oh, is he one that got
He got
kicked
kicked
out?
out of the state house.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about, I guess about a week ago.
Did you see his transformation from when he was in college,
No.
2016 to what he became?
No.
Okay, let's watch. This is. It's being reported. This is like an SNL skit. This is crazy. He's a black guy doing a caricature of like a black preacher, you know? This is him in college running for some office.
Okay.
It makes me like refresh the page every time to get it to play again. So I get these queued up and then I have to go back into the window. So here we go. Look at this big fat white lady. She's standing with him. She loves him.
Is she the, she might be the third person who was part of the protest,
Oh.
the woman who did not get kicked out.
Yeah. Well,
That's so weird that
okay, here we go.
all right there.
Justin J. Pearson, and I'm running for president of BSG. There are a few reasons that we're running this campaign this year.
So this is him at Bowdoin College, which is like, I don't know if it's Ivy League, but it's like Ivy League adjacent. It's in Maine, like Maine. And, it's not a Southern black college or anything like that. The guy that quarterback for my... Actually, the guy who I played high school football with, the quarterback of our team, he got a scholarship to play football there. But this is him running for a class something in college.
One has to do with representation. How can we represent all voices in a conversation? I wanted to do this by partnering with organizations from the Bowdoin Democrats to the Bowdoin Republicans. I want to bring together different voices, dissenting voices, voices that may be more liberal or more conservative, in order that we can reach a point of sort of the radical middle.
If you guys are watching, he's wearing like khakis, navy
tie.
He's wearing like a Ben Shapiro type outfit. He's got short hair. And now,
clean cut.
That's 2016. Jump ahead to 2023, he's in the government. He's got an afro, and he's summoning his inner Al Sharpton.
NRA and gun lobbyists might win, but oh, that was good news for us. I don't know how long this Saturday in the state of Tennessee might last, but oh, we have good news, folks. We've got good news that Sunday always comes.
What do you think of that, Deborah?
That's quite a transformation.
Yeah, they hate your guts. They think that you're so stupid, and that's aimed at your demographic, like upper middle class liberal white ladies who hate guns. Like, that's who that guy is going for, and he probably got him with that, you know.
He studied King and
yeah, it's just a grift, you know. You find that offensive? Like, he's like a white black guy doing a black guy impersonation.
I wonder where he grew up.
Well, I mean, he went to...
Doesn't sound like he grew up in Tennessee.
Yeah,
I mean, it does now, but it didn't. He went to 7 years ago.
New England college.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the bushes.
Yeah.
But everybody will tell you, hey, you got to get out of Oregon. You got to move to Tennessee because it's super based. Like, obviously, it's trans people killing Christians there. We see guys like this. We see drag brunch in Nashville. You guys can have it. Good luck in 10 years.
Well, they're all reinstated again.
Yeah, reinstated. So he got kicked out because he had like said something about gun control on the heels of that, of the trans person killing the Christian children.
Right.
Got it.
Yeah. Yep.
That's what they'll do. They'll take the first chance that they can get. Never let a good crisis go to waste. Rahm Emanuel. Do you have anything else, Deborah?
Well, I have something about the security breach in Ireland regarding Biden's trip, but it's not all that interesting. Okay. You want to hear about it?
Yeah. Why don't you try your best to keep
okay. it? Okay. All right. Oh my God. I'll have to use a different voice. All right. So
like Justin Pearson.
I don't think I can. Anyhow, Biden landed, I think it was Monday night, in Northern Ireland to meet with their prime minister. And they had imported like 300 police officers from all over the UK to, you know, for his security. Yeah, 300. All right. So the Police Service of Northern Ireland, the PSNI, somebody dropped a document marked PSNI and sensitive, and was found by just some person walking down the street, a member of the public. And the document showed where Biden is staying in North Ireland. It also included phone numbers of senior PSNI officers, a detailed itinerary of Biden's visit. PSNI says, we are aware of security breach and an investigation has commenced, and we have notified the senior information risk officer. We take the safety of visiting dignitaries, members of the public, and our officers and staff extremely seriously, and we'll put the appropriate actions in place. So there's more, but that was kind of the gist of it.
Do you think, they're lucky someone from the IRA didn't find it or something. They would have.
It's probably dropped by the same guy who did the, the low level guy who,
the Ukraine leaks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got a little bit on that, but let's hear. I found this fun picture of video of Joe Biden. What percentage are you that there is one Joe Biden, and the Joe Biden that you've seen for your whole adult life is the same one that's around these days?
Mm-hmm. Now, that's, I mean, I know we've touched on that in the past, but I don't think I could come up with a number.
But it's not 100%.
No, it's not 100%.
You're saying there's a chance that
there's a chance that there's a clone.
What about clones, not just body doubles?
Body doubles. Sorry, I misspoke.
What about like these latex mask things?
Oh, and all this CGI. God only knows what's going to happen in the future, but I don't know. I don't know.
This guy, I forget his name, but he's like an actor, and people like put pictures of him online and say this is Joe Biden's double. But watch this video.
Okay.
I'll refresh it so we can see it. This is on Twitter also. Come on now. Okay. It was riveting podcasting. Oh man, I had it. It was awesome. Oh, here we go.
Oh, there. Good.
North Carolina. And he was a very conservative guy who was very, very.
Oh my gosh. That's the.
You can't really see.
Man.
African American.
Holy cow.
He always had fights.
Well, the key to success.
Let's see.
North Carolina. And he was a very conservative guy.
Can you expand the.
Very, very.
Oh my gosh, that's a map.
African American.
Holy cow.
He always had fights.
Well, the key to success.
North Carolina. And he was a very conservative guy.
Oh my gosh, that's a map. Holy cow.
It's. Sure looked like a mask.
Yeah, so what we're seeing, if you guys are just listening, it's Joe Biden with his back turned, and he goes and he sticks his pointer finger in his old liver spotted neck and scratches it. Like finger like sinks in, and he like pulls it around, and then there's like a bunch of ripples in the skin, like where it's like a mask meeting the person's neck who's wearing it.
Wow. I wonder who said, oh my God, that's a mask.
I think it was just somebody like recording that off the they recorded their TV.
Fun.
Yeah. Oh, remember how we were going to do the thing about the Orthodox Judaism and it gave me the 404 message?
Yeah.
It came back. So let's see if it'll come back this time. We'll do a little reading on that. This is a fun title, The Child Rape Assembly Line. Rabbi Nuchum Rosenberg, who is 63 with a long grain beard, recently sat down with me to explain what he described as a child rape assembly line among sects of fundamentalist Jews. And I put the disclaimer out, it's not just fundamentalist Jews. It's every organized religion there is. This goes on. Some more than others. You know, I'd argue the, can rabbis get married, right?
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah, it's, I don't think my church is excluded from any of this, but I think it's much, much less because I think, our priests are married with families, and, you know, Catholic priests don't get married. And, you know, who
do we hear about?
Yeah, who would want that? You know, who would gravitate towards that? Buck Johnson has this this Orthodox chaplain on his show this last week, and he had a pretty good quote about he just asked the guy if there's some religions where the pastor or priest or whatever are usually lower testosterone kind of guys, because he was talking about masculinity. And he said, like, well, if there's going to be like someone who can't get married and have sex with someone, like, who, you know, that's probably going to be that guy. Somebody that wants to like get married and have sex is probably not going to want to not do that. And he quotes, he talks about, have you ever seen Nacho Libre with Jack Black?
Yes. I know what you're talking about. I haven't seen it, but.
Yeah, there's this one point. He's like he's a monk in a monastery. He doesn't want to be, just because he was just like raised there, you know, and he falls in love with a nun. And he talks to the priest and asks him, like, oh, how is it being a priest? And he's like, oh, it's amazing. I get to sleep in my bed without a woman for the rest of my life, you know. Okay, so Rabbi Neuchem Rosenberg, who was 63, with a long-graying beard, monk says, he cleared his throat. I'm going to be graphic, he said. It's going to get graphic, Deborah.
Okay.
But, you've been reading Program to Kill, so you're a little bit desensitized to this type of thing. But you probably know that it's more prevalent than you once wanted to believe. A member of Brooklyn's Satmar Hasidim fundamentalist branch of Orthodox Judaism, Neuchem designs and repairs mikvahs in compliance with Torah law. The mikvah is a ritual Jewish bathhouse. You ever been to one?
No. Because
you weren't. It's just for Orthodox ones, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Used for purification. Devout Jews are required to cleanse themselves in the mikvah on a variety of occasions. Women must visit following menstruation, and men have to make an appearance before the high holidays such as Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Many of the devout also purify themselves before and after the act of sex and before the Sabbath. On a visit to Jerusalem in 2005, Rabbi Rosenberg entered into a mikveh in one of the holiest neighborhoods in the city, Mea Shearim. I opened a door that entered into a schwitz, he told me. Vapors everywhere. I can barely see. My eyes adjust, and I see an old man, my age, long white beard, a holy-looking man sitting on the vapors. On his lap, facing away from him, is a boy, maybe 7 years old, and the old man is having anal sex with this boy.
Oh, my God.
Rabbi Rosenberg paused, gathering himself, and went on. This boy was speared on the man like an animal, like a pig, and the boy was saying nothing but on his face, fear. The old man, without any fear, as if this was common practice. He didn't stop. I was so angry, I confronted him. He removed the boy from his penis, and I took the boy aside. I told this man, it's a sin before God, a mishkovzucher. What are you doing to this boy's soul? You're destroying this boy. He had a sponge on a stick to clean his back, and he hit me across the face with it. How dare you interrupt me, he said. I heard of these things for a long time, but now I had seen.
Oh, my God.
The child sex abuse crisis in ultra-Orthodox Judaism, like that in the Catholic Church, has produced its share of shocking headlines in recent years. In New York and in the prominent Orthodox communities of Israel and London, allegations of child molestation and rape have been rampant. The alleged abusers are school teachers, rabbis, fathers, uncles, figures of male authority. The victims, like those of Catholic priests, are mostly boys. Rabbi Rosenberg believes around half of young males in Brooklyn's Hasidic community half of the young boys in Brooklyn's Hasidic community, the largest in the United States and one of the largest in the world, have been victims of sexual assault perpetrated by their elders.
Wow.
50%, Deborah. That's the Catholic Church isn't that high. Catholic Church is probably 1%, you know? And that's worth it. Ben Hirsch, director of Survivors for Justice, a Brooklyn organization that advocates for Orthodox sex abuse victims, thinks the real number of anecdotal evidence, we're looking at over 50%. It has almost become a rite of passage.
Oh my God.
And this is from Vice, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This isn't 4chan, you know? Ultra-Orthodox Jews who speak out about these abuses are ruined and condemned to exile by their own community. Dr. Amy Neustein, a non-fundamentalist Orthodox Jewish sociologist and editor of The Tempest in Temple, Jewish Communities and Child Sex Scandals, told me the story of a series of Hasidic mothers in Brooklyn she got to know who complained that their children were being preyed on by husbands. In these cases, the accused men very quickly and effectively engaged the rabbis. The Orthodox politicians and powerful Orthodox rabbis who donate handsomely to political clubs. The goal, she told me, is to excise the mother from the child's life. Rabbinical courts cast the mothers aside and the effects are permanent. The mother is amputated. One woman befriended by Dr. Neustein, a music student at a college outside New York, lost contact with all six of her children, including an infant she was breastfeeding at the time of their separation. There's a documentary on Netflix about like the exiled people who leave this community. They don't get, but they do show one young boy who ends up like addicted to drugs and stuff who left, and he talks about getting molested. But they show like the mother and getting the, like them trying to take her kids away from her and like what they do and how they
good lord
do like bands together against these people who are trying to leave. I forget the name of the documentary, but it's on Netflix.
That's really hideous.
Yeah. 7 years ago, Rabbi Rosenberg started blogging about sex abuse in his community. So, I mean, he's exposing it from the inside, which is commendable. Not anybody else is doing it. And opened a New York City hotline to field sex abuse complaints. He has posted appeals on YouTube, appeared on CNN, and given speeches across the U.S., Canada, Israel, and Australia. Today, he is the lone whistleblower among the Satmar. For this, he is reviled, slandered, hated, feared. He receives death threats on a regular basis in Yiddish and Hebrew newspapers, advertisements taken out by the self-described great rabbis and rabbinical judges of New York, of the city of New York, have denounced him as a stumbling block for the House of Israel. A public rebuker and preacher of ethics who persists in his rebelliousness and whose voice has been heard among many Jewish families, especially young people in their innocence, drawn to listen to his poisonous and revolting speeches. That's a quote.
But they don't deny it. They just attack him.
Yeah. Leaflets distributed in Williamsburg and Borough Park, the centers of ultra-Orthodox in Brooklyn, display his bearded face over the body of a writhing snake. Corrupt informer, reads one of the leaflets, followed by the declaration that Rabbi Rosenberg's name should rot in hell forever. They should cut him off from all corners of the earth. Yeah, it goes on and on. It's long. It's not that long, but we'll cut it off. So, yeah.
That's really hideous.
Yeah. It's very interesting, though, that it's sort of well-known and widely accepted. Yeah, the Catholic one is widely known about, but I think people just kind of, yeah, same thing. People kind of turn their backs, and these communities are so insulated.
Mm-hmm.
These people, even though they grow up in these cities, like, if they get cast out, they don't know how to, like, they're like Amish, you know, they don't know.
Yeah,
how to,
they don't have any life skills for them.
In, like, Brooklyn, but they kind of have a support network where they're allowed, you know, where you can stay in the community and you're always kind of taken care of. You'll have a job and you know.
50%. That's really
wild, huh?
And fathers who allow their sons, I mean, who victimize their sons and then take them away from their mothers.
Yeah.
That's really,
really disturbing. Yeah. And like if these in that documentary I was watching, like mothers were trying to like leave the thing and they were trying to take their babies away from them and stuff like that. And yeah, there's no like partial custody, you know. There's also a movie on made about it, on like a fictional movie on Netflix made about it, about some girl who kind of leaves after she was like forced into a marriage. So I forget what that one was called too.
I think I saw that.
Yeah. But like I said, every organized religion, it happens. But in these communities that are insulated like that, it's probably just much, much easier. It's just so strange that it always comes to this. Like,
what does that say about us as a species, that so many, it happens to so many children?
Yeah, I know, it's horrific that and so prevalent, people don't even realize, like, I mean, this so I just got to the chapter in Program to Kill about Henry Lee Lucas, so hopefully I'm kind of out of the the organized pedophilia part of the book. But yeah, it's like the first 70 pages of the book is case after case, and they're all kind of like stuff that, like, do you remember the McMartin?
Yeah, but the preschool kind of got,
like, explained away by the media, right? Like, as being
right.
I mean, what is it, what do you think now that you've heard all these things, from like McMartin to Finders to like these different, like there's those other ones, like that daycare center in Florida, the husband and wife, the guy, he was like a convicted rapist and was allowed to start a daycare center after he got out of prison. Like,
and just how, you know, the story goes nowhere, you know, all of a sudden it's all just tied up neatly in a package and nobody gets sent to jail. It just goes away.
Yeah, there was only one in that huge list that Dave McGowan cites, and it, that where anybody got in trouble for it, it was because it was like police officers' children's that it happened to.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm looking forward to getting into Henry Lee Lucas. I just rewatched that Henry Lee Lucas documentary on HBO as well.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I don't know if I've seen that one.
Oh, you should watch it. It's really good.
Yeah, I will.
The Confession Killer.
Yeah, because he confessed to what, like 500?
Yeah. He was like their little pet of the jail. And the guy from the Texas Rangers, like the head of the Texas Rangers, wherever he was, like, just, he just palled around with him. He had free reign of the jail. He would just walk around. They'd give him like ice cream and cigarettes and unlimited coffee. And people from all over the country just started like being like, oh, there's this wild serial killer. And they would call this guy and be like, hey, was this guy in Tacoma, Washington, in da-da-da-da-da? And they'd be like, well, it's possible. So those guys would go there and they would clear murder cases. He would just.
Yeah. Yeah. He'd say, yeah, I did it. And so then they could close the books on that case.
Yeah.
Got this one cleared up.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, he stayed out. He got special privileges. He was like a kind of a, you know, a dimwit kind of guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can like pin one murder on him. Like he killed like his girlfriend or something. Or maybe his mom. I can't remember which one. But, yeah, they, at one point they show like a map and like, you know, like Indiana Jones, they show like where it's like driving to, and like he had to drive, he drove like 6 miles in like 6,000 miles in like 3 days once to do like 20 murders or something like that. It's crazy.
He didn't have time to murder people. He was
on
the road. Years ago, before my children were born, and my husband and I were camping in Yosemite, and we did a river rafting.
Oh, when you took LSD.
That's the time. I guess I've already told you this story. And we're in the camp store, and there's a long line because the one employee is trying to mess with the coffee machine in the back. And there's this long line of people waiting to buy their stuff. And I turn around and go, oh my God, it's Henry Lee Lucas. I was sure it was Henry Lee Lucas behind me in line. Of course it wasn't, but
yeah. It was, and had you already dropped the acid when that happened?
Or? Yeah.
it was just starting to kick in.
Yeah. No. It was already kicked in.
Is that when it all went bad, or it had already gone bad?
It went bad as soon as we got off the little boat and had to get back on a bus to take us back up to where we started. And it was very crowded. And I thought I was on the train to Auschwitz.
Oh my God.
That's when it went bad. Eric had to like stand over me.
Yeah.
Protect me.
Had he done LSD as well?
Yeah.
But he was handling it a little better.
Yeah.
He seems kind of like the guy that would freak out on acid to me, but I'm glad that he didn't.
I'm really glad he didn't.
Yeah.
I just went back to our tent and lay down and put the covers over my head and just waited it out.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll get into that. You know, like maybe we'll just become a murder podcast, just like everybody else. I'm my patience for the news cycle and the material world around us is really wearing thin, you know.
Yeah.
But we both like talking about murder, so.
Yeah, murder and music.
I got that book about the Chicago Rippers.
Yeah. Okay. That $900 book.
Yeah, I got it for $7 on Amazon, and everywhere else it's like $100.
Yeah. I think it was $400 on Amazon.
Really?
But yes. I believe it was.
Man.
It was something really crazy. And then I just searched everywhere and.
Yeah. I forget who was saying it. I think it was Jay Dyer. He was saying it. He just like puts books in his wish list, you know? And they'll be like $300. And then, but like then every once in a while, he'll like 2 years later, like it'll like pop up in his email. Like, well, this is what you wanted. It's $7.
Uh-huh.
I think I just like looked at the exact right time.
Yeah, you did.
My first try. It's called Deadly Thrills. It's about the Chicago Rippers. It's pretty short. So I'll read that and we'll do an episode on it.
And there's a website. I'll get to the name of it, but I found a 30-minute story on the Rippers.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Right on. Well, I think we should call it there, Deborah.
Alrighty.
All right. Thanks for doing this. And we will be back next week. And Patreon guys, thank you for giving me the week off. I will, I'll make it up to you.
Yeah. You will.
Thank you, Deborah, very much.
Love you, Adam.
Thank you guys for all the support.
Get some rest and eat a. I don't know whether you should eat a lot in the next day or so, or a little to get you ready.
All right. Well, I just had a cup of coffee with like honey in it because I don't like drinking black coffee, but that's all that's going to be available to me. So.
Okay.
Right on. Well, thank you guys, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yes.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.